back to Talking Success. As you've been following us over the last sort of 5 or 6 weeks, we've had a tremendous amount of support from a very well-known company called LexisNexis Risk Solutions. They're obviously part of the wider LexisNexis group. And I think it would be only fair to give them a bit of a chance to come on and talk a bit about their views, what they're seeing in the market when it comes to combating financial crime, when it comes to regulatory controls and compliance. So we have an expert in financial crime, combating financial crime, not an expert in doing financial crime, but an expert in combating financial crime, all the way from Paris this afternoon. We have Vincent Gaudel, and I hope I've done his surname justice. As you know, if you've been listening to this, I really struggle with certain names, especially from the African continent. And then when they throw in a French name as well, it's it really throws me. But Vincent, listen, thank you so much for coming on the show. Great to have you on board. Before we get into kind of this really serious topic, we're going to try and make it as obviously as conversational and as lighthearted as we possibly can. But before we get into that, I'd love to get a quick introduction, a bit about you, a bit about your career and what you do at LexisNexis Risk Solutions.
Sure. Hi, everyone. And thanks, Darren, for having me. Just to make you feel comfortable, you got my name perfectly well. So thanks for that. really, really delighted to be part of this this fantastic podcast. So yeah, as you said, my role, so I work with LexisNexis Risk Solutions. My role is to provide expertise on financial crime compliance requirements, monitor regulatory trends in the field of sanctions, money laundering regulations, terrorism financing, and all of the connected areas. I've been in the company for 6.5 years, previously working in compliance within the financial sector and different types of institutions, but always with an excuse on those questions on financial crime, etc. And so, yeah, as you said, we are a known global provider of some of
maybe the best we can kind of get into this, if that's
very
okay,
important.
Maybe we can get into this. And I think when we talk about compliance and we talk about, regulatory controls, when we are talking about things like payments or we're talking about lending, each country has their own regulatory frameworks that they need to adhere to. But when we're talking about financial crime, specifically around money laundering, actually, there's a much wider regulatory framework around this, which is more sort of a global mindset. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? So what are the differences between local regulations and regulators versus kind of the overarching regulations that apply to every company or every country on the planet?
Sure. So I think essentially to keep it at a high level, but it's fair to state, as you mentioned, that different countries may have different tradition and attitude towards banking, towards finance, even towards like legal systems in general. So you may have different functioning in different jurisdictions. But the trick with financial crime and money laundering is that it's a global threat, right? It's a common issue that every country is faced, basically. And so, those questions, those risks, they exist for quite a long time. And actually, the responses maybe started in the 70s in the US. The first act to fight against money laundering started back then. But very early on, fairly early on at least, there was a realization that there was a need for global standards. There was a need for countries to come together and agree on a common set of standards. And actually, the first time that happened was with the creation of the FATF. So I'm sure it has become a very famous acronym in South Africa. Well, that thing, the FATF.
It has. Yeah.
Do you know when it was created? It's in operation since 1989. Right. So since that time, we had that group, that intention, at least, to address money laundering, organized crime at the international level. And so basically, the idea is that even though different countries have different banking laws or banking systems, we face a common set of risks. And to an extent, we need to adopt a common set of responses in order to have a concerted defense against those risks.
Without sort of belittling anything, but does that make things a little easier? for you guys at LexisNexis Risk Solutions, or for corporates generally, because there is this kind of global standard. It's not left to an individual regulator in an individual country to then sort of form their own controls and policies around this. So is it an easier thing to tackle because it's a global framework?
Yeah, I think it's a fair remark. Not to say that it's an easy task by any means, but
yeah.
but the spirit is the same everywhere, right? You need to, like, the big thing with money laundering regulations is to adopt a risk-based approach, right? So that's a common theme in the entire world. But now, depending on where you operate, in what industry or what geography you operate, the risk will be different, but you still have the need to adopt a risk-based approach, right? So the methodology will be the same, but the outcome will be different depending on where you operate. So yeah, to an extent, yeah, it's useful for everyone to work on a common set of standards, but now they take a different flavor depending on the exposure.
I think there's perhaps a misconception that it's just the banks and the FSPs, financial services providers, that need to comply or need to worry about AML specifically. But actually, when we look at that and we look at the layer down in terms of maybe merchant activity, and obviously there's lots of different types of merchants, but if we're looking at real estate, we're looking at automobiles, we're looking at I don't know, there must be others, but they're the two that came to mind. That they need to be able to comply to these AML standards because, big ticket purchases are made, especially when it comes to property. I was reading something just last week, actually, about, I think it was two ladies in the UK that went on a buying spree of properties for like £20 million a property. And it was because, they found some Bitcoin, but clearly it had come from an unscrupulous source. But the responsibility for combating money laundering isn't just at the banking level. It goes across industry. Do you have a comment on that? Do you have a view on that?
Of course, yeah, it's correct, and I think it's an important remark. So if you look at the way the FATF puts it, you have requirements for the financial institution, for the financial sector as a whole, which, to be fair, like, it's pretty obvious that they store the assets, they handle the transfer of funds of assets, so that they are the obvious primary, like the front line to money laundering, for sure. But if you think about it, there are various other professions that may be instrumental in any attempt to make illicit funds look legitimate. You gave the example of the real estate sector. It's pretty obvious that if a real estate professional doesn't look for the source of funds when they facilitate a purchase, they may be facilitating a laundering scheme, for sure. You have this set of professions. So in FATF standards, they are called, it's a very barbaric acronym. It's called DNFBPs, the Designated Non-Financial Businesses and Professions, right?
They could have come up with a better acronym for that, surely, right?
They are not famous for the catchy acronyms. That's for sure. But the essence of these professions is that indeed certain non-financial professionals are instrumental in any attempt to launder funds. So the key ones are obviously real estate sector, the gambling industry, lawyers, and these companies that provide what they call trust and company service providers. Right. So we'll talk about that later on, but the misuse of legal persons, of legal arrangements to hide who's holding the funds. This is a key weakness. This is a key issue. Right. So those professionals also have an exposure to money laundering risks, and therefore they should do something about it. Right. So, and you have probably topical in South Africa, but dealers in precious metals, precious stones as well. They can be used to disguise or to move funds across borders more easily. So they also have an exposure and should have some degree of regulation for those issues. Just one last thing, because I think it's very important and very, very interesting. The compliance level, if you look at like today's situation, if you look at FATF assessments, like at the global level, like right now, there have been 170 countries that went through the assessment. So it's possible to look at, you know, like the overall state of compliance at the global level. And those questions about how those non-financial professions are actually scrutinized or required to implement measures, that's one of the burning issues globally. That's one of the weak spots, because that's where on average countries comply the least. So you have that that weak links, so to speak. So even though, like, in general, what you see is that the largest, the global financial institutions, they're pretty well aware of those requirements. They do, they have things in place for sure. Smaller financial institutions, well, sometimes it's lagging a little bit, but the non-financial sector, it's almost always the weak spot.
One thing you mentioned there is about lawyers and law firms. Can you hear me okay? Sorry, Vincent.
Yeah.
So, I'm going to pick up on one thing you said there, which was about lawyers and law firms. And I'm not going to describe what I saw, because someone might accuse me of giving, you know, hints away about how to launder money. But I saw something on one of the social media platforms, because I follow things about financial crime. And this individual went through how I can launder money in like 2 days. And he used a law firm to launder money, okay? And again, I'm not going to go through how he did it. That's not for me to discuss. But it was so easy, I'm going to use that word. There was no checks and balances done. The law firm, as far as they were concerned, they were taking a retainer, quite a large retainer from a client. And, you know, they was going to pay their fees. A few days later, obviously, the person in question went, actually, I'm not going to proceed with this, you know, this case. Can you just deposit my money back into this account? And lo and behold, you know, that was done. So I think people, you know, underestimate the amount of money laundering that actually happens in the professional sector. Okay, you mentioned mining, you mentioned real estate, we mentioned the legal system. And that's one area. Now, obviously, there's a whole other part of the call it ecosystem, because I'm going to get shot for saying that. But there's a whole nother part of the world of where we live, which is, you know, all of this kind of dark web and illicit trading and drugs and, you know, arms and all of this side. Is that completely different? I mean, as a business, LexisNexis Risk Solutions, do you also get involved in sort of combating crime when it comes to that part of society, or are you mainly focused on sort of professional services and enterprise and corporates?
But we are mostly focused on the kind of, the legacy profession, but you're right to mention that there is these alternative financial systems. So we were talking about crypto here and all of the underlying activities, maybe, or at least part of it. But just, we are also servicing crypto asset firms, right? So crypto exchanges. Yeah. Because, at the end of the day, there needs to be an entry point and an exit point for in and out of that world, right? So before you can transact in Bitcoins and buy some illegal drugs or you name it through the dark web, at some point you will need to get some dollars on a platform and change it into Bitcoin. And that's something that was clearly identified as an important getaway, right? So now in most jurisdictions, I don't know the exact requirements in South Africa, but you have this sense that companies providing crypto asset services, they need to apply customer due diligence. They need to ask about the source of funds. They need to monitor transactions. They need to do the same thing compared to what is required from a traditional financial institution. So yeah, there is a realization of that.
I don't want to get into the complexities of cryptocurrency. That's one for another day. But I think that the general sort of idea around cryptocurrency at a fundamental level is to have it decentralized. Okay. And there's a whole group of people that are striving for decentralization of financial services. Okay. So I am custody of my own, custodian of my own money, and I do what I want with that, and it's mine, and da da da. Now, is there a point where people's privacy and regulation hits a point, and you go, actually, there's a line here? Because I know, looking at your profile, Vincent, you've done a lot of work in GDPR, you've done a lot of work in sort of policies and regulatory around data and sort of sovereignty of your data. Is there a line, or is there no line? Because actually, this is criminalized, and this is kind of, I don't know, something else.
So I think it's a very interesting question. I think you made a very important point. If you have pure decentralization, you don't have an intermediary that will check you, right? And so basically, from that standpoint, you have a fundamental contradiction between the spirit of cryptocurrency and the way the AML standards are built, because they rely on those intermediaries to be the gatekeepers, right? So there are, in my opinion, that's my personal view here, but you have two ways forward. So first, and that's I think what we are seeing right now in the current developments of regulatory responses, is that you re-intermediate crypto, and you require those intermediaries to do exactly like the payment service providers do, right? So, but that's no longer crypto, and actually you cannot force someone to use an exchange to transact in Bitcoin. If I have my, as you said, if I have self custody of my funds, I can send Bitcoin to your wallet, and nobody will take will have a view on that, right? Well, except the public storage in the blockchain, but nobody can block it, or nobody can ask me question, right? And so that's one side. So do we want to mirror the existing standards to crypto? But that requires intermediary, and it will never be perfect. Now, the other responses, and I think more interesting, at least from an intellectual standpoint, is how do we invent new compliance solutions? How do we apply standards differently? How do we have, I don't know, I think in DeFi now you have some contracts that implement Oracle verifications or that monitor kind of a decentralized compliance solution as well, right? To have things that are monitored as they go, as they happen in the blockchain, and that, yeah, maybe raised or maybe addressed differently, at least. That makes sense.
And as part of the LexisNexis Risk Solutions product suite, when you are looking at a crypto asset service provider as a potential customer to try and help them navigate compliance and regulatory controls, is it very similar to if you were doing that for a payment service provider? Is it almost the same solution, or does it have to be different because you're looking at various different sort of coins? There's going to be a lot more sort of international movement of funds. Is it very different? Is it similar? How does that work?
It's both, actually. So you have the baseline. The baseline is identical. So doing a KYC, doing like a customer due diligence, asking the questions, this is no different. Like keeping an ID of your customers is something like so. So basically, a crypto firm can use the solutions that we have been providing to the legacy financial system for one piece of the requirements, right? To have good knowledge of their customer base, screen them against sanctions list, PEP list, you name it. But there is a set of capabilities that is specific to the crypto ecosystem, and that's really the blockchain monitoring controls. So that's, it exists in the traditional financial sector, obviously, right? You have transaction monitoring tools, spotting suspicious activities, suspicious transactions that don't correspond to what you know about your customers, like in a vacuum. That's what it is about. For crypto, it's to an extent, it's way broader than that, because all of the transactions are in front of your eyes, right? So you have dedicated solutions. That's not something that we provide to the market currently, but you have specialist firms that have built blockchain analytics platforms that they monitor everything that of what is going on, and it's kind of an advanced way to monitor transactions because it's a holistic view of transactions.
Cool. Okay. We spoke about AML. There are obviously other elements of financial crime that not only you as a business sort of offer in terms of solutions, but Can you talk through what they are? I'd say most people would have heard of, you know, money laundering and PEP screening and sanction lists and what have you. What are the other sort of areas within financial crime that are either pertinent now or are starting to become a bit more of a trend?
Yeah, so there indeed, so maybe money laundering to some extent is like the common denominator, because so one big thing that is growing bigger and bigger actually is obviously fraud. But fraud is like directly connected to money laundering, because fraud is basically a predicate crime that generates proceeds that need to be laundered. So you have this continuum of like fraudster scamming someone, getting funds, and now they need to distantiate themselves from the illicit source of those funds. So you have this connection between fraud and AML, and we can rediscuss later. But if you manage to disrupt fraud in the first place, but this is proceeds that won't need to be laundered. So in a way, you help your money laundering controls if you prevent the commission of the predicate crime. So that's one thing, fraud and AML. That's something that we particularly look at. The other element is sanctions. Maybe we'll touch upon that later. But that's an area of immense challenges and growing challenges. Very complex because it's multifaceted, it's fragmented landscape. And the particular aspect of sanctions is really the strict liability attached to those regulations. So I mentioned earlier the risk-based nature of requirements in relation to AML. For sanctions, you can't get it wrong any single time. Otherwise, it's a breach and you risk enforcement responses that can be pretty extreme. The last element maybe to mention, because you talked about PEP screening. PEP screening refers back to corruption. And corruption is kind of its own animal in a way, because it's an enabler to many other different bad activities, right? So corruption is central because you don't want corrupt public officials to enjoy the proceeds of their illicit dealings, right? So there is also the fight against corruption that is very instrumental to connect in the broader FCC area.
Let's put the fraud one first, and then I definitely want to talk about sanctions, because it's very topical at the moment, and I think it probably always will be. But let's talk about fraud. There are obviously lots of different types of fraud. Again, are you seeing more of a threat for sort of cyber security and cyber hacks? Is it more that these days they're getting more sophisticated? You know, I know there was a big sort of thing quite a few years ago about... forget the terminology, but you know, a hacker will come in and basically lock your network, and you have to send him Bitcoin for him to unlock. Is that thing still happening, or is that now evolved and it's become more sophisticated? What do those threats look like?
So I'll make a quick disclaimer. I don't know what is going. This is not my area of expertise, the fraud, right? So maybe the other guys, but I can try to reconnect it with other stuff. So the fraud threats, they are only getting worse. And fraudsters are really adept at like using innovative technology, leveraging the digital nature of payments, digital services, etc. So chances are that. So right now, like fraud is one of the largest proceeds generating criminal activities. If you look at different reports from the US, from the UK, it comes on par, if not bigger than drugs trafficking in some of the largest economies already, right? And I don't know if you are aware of that, but that's really a huge problem. Up to a point that, it's connected to sanctions, to AML, it's connected to everything, because right now what you have is that you have fraudsters that are organized crime groups. It is being committed at a scale. It's no longer just an isolated fraudster in their basement that do their small scale scam. It's really like you have a state-backed group of hackers in North Korea. It's one of the main revenue sources for North Korea, like acts of crypto exchanges. Don't know if you knew that, but it's really like a great portion of their GDP is money that they get from scamming well, actually it's far from acts, so it's not like technically you're just defrauding someone from their proceeds. But the thing is that it has become really like a very professional set of activities. There is an emerging pattern that is pretty concerning, something called the pig butchering scams. I don't know if you have heard about this one. So in these types of schemes, you have organized crime group that trick people to come to a foreign country, luring them into some decent work. But in the end, it's purely human trafficking. They confiscate the passports. They put them in a kind of a sweatshop. They are being trained to go after people to fraud into murky crypto exchange scams. And basically, why is it called pig butchering? It's because it's a scam in the long run. So you spot a target that seems to be, so you look at the social media of that person, you see someone that seems to be well off, well enough, right? And you engage a relationship with them. You tell them that, you are very successful in your life. And after maybe a couple of weeks, you mention that, oh, yeah, you found something great on the crypto exchange that gives you like fantastic returns. And you don't push them to invest. But if you have established that relationship, they will want to be part of it. And you start milking the cow that way. Right? Those persons, they will say, okay, I'll give it a little bit, I'll give it a few hundreds, maybe a few thousands, maybe just to try. And obviously you see it's a fake site, so you see that the returns going up, and then you can start putting pressure on the guys and you can start really milking them up to a point where the fraudster feel like, so it's not actually milking the code that they use. They say the pig is fat enough. And so if they feel like they have taken enough from you, they say, okay, ready to slaughter you. And they cut everything, they're gone, your money's gone, over. But what's really crazy about this is first, like, how, in a way, ingenious it is. It takes, like, it goes over a month. The person that frauds you is actually also the victim of human trafficking, right? And so they have a pressure. They are being tortured if they are not successful to get a target, right? So it's really nuts. Up to a point that it has becoming such a threat that now I see sanctions program by OFAC or by the international regulators going after these organized crime groups. So you see, you have fraudulent activities that trigger sanctions responses back because it's becoming really a threat of a large scale. But anyway, that connects all of the issues.
Talk sanctions. Let's not mention any specific countries. I don't want to be accused of anything, but a sanction is implemented on a particular country, okay, for whatever reason. How do you then go about enforcing compliance to those sanctions or to that sanction? Because, correct me if I'm wrong here, but sanctions have different levels, okay? So some trade is allowed, some trade isn't allowed. You can do this, you can't do that. But it seems to be very fluid. Right, so these get changed quite regularly. How do you keep up? How is an organization supposed to keep up? Is there a set sort of rules going, listen, these countries just stay away from? Or is it a case of, you know, you guys have got some technology and some services that you can offer, which is kind of real time and says, actually, yeah, this is fine. Actually, no, this is kind of like on the red list or black list or whatever it may be. How does that work in the real world?
So that there are different types of sanctions. So what you refer to, like countrywide sanctions, commonly called embargo sanctions, they used to be the way to go. But increasingly, it's no longer about countrywide sanctions, and instead, so we like to name them smart sanctions or targeted sanctions. So you work instead of a list of countries, you have an actual list of targets, right? So, so for example, if you go on the US regulators website, so probably the most important list or the largest, at least for sure, list in the world, if you look for the list of country, they clearly tell you, we don't maintain a list of country, right? We have a list of persons, of entities. So the first, like the bottom line for compliance is that you take that list of targets and you make sure that you don't have any involvement with those persons. And if you do, you terminate, you freeze, you report, and then you're clear, theoretically. But there are also, on top of that, there are also sanctions measures that indeed don't apply just to a set of targets, and they apply to countries or even to regions. So there are only a handful of those, at least for the US sanctions, but it's not that common that the sanctions measure are what we would call comprehensive restrictions and banning basically all dealings with a particular foreign jurisdiction. So you have the usual suspect, like we can maybe name one country, like North Korea. It's under comprehensive sanctions or full embargo by the international community. So it comes from the UN, actually. So the whole international community agrees that, yeah, I mean, North Korea is really a rogue state, like nothing should go through with them. You can argue whether that is actually the case, but that's the intention at least. But yeah, bottom line is, for the most part, countries want the effect of sanctions to be really specific on a clear set of targets, for the most part. Does that answer your question? Because
it does. I've got a follow-up question, if I may. And sorry if this is trivial, but so the US imposes a sanction on a country, on an entity or an individual, okay, that person or that entity is sanctioned. I'm in South Africa, and South Africa doesn't have those sanctions against that individual or that company. Am I, as a South African, still allowed to trade with that organization as long as it's not using US dollars? Or is that quite murky? Does everyone just follow the US because, you know, they're sort of setting the global policies? How does it work?
How does it work? So there are different responses to this question, because there is the legal reality, and then there is the risk appetite of you or your bank, right? So you mentioned, so first, like the easy part, if you are a US person, so you may have, like what I mean by, you may have a direct exposure because you are under the jurisdiction of the US. So here, no brainer, sure. You need to comply.
Yeah.
Now the next step is there is a nexus with the US financial system, because it's US dollar, or because the data or whatever is supposed to transit through, or the service is supposed to transit through data center, or like any touch point with the US, really digitally or materially, like any touch point.
Sure.
Essentially means you're under the hook, you're under jurisdiction by the US. Outside of that, theoretically, you should be clear. However, the US has a last tool in the toolkit. It's what are called secondary sanctions. Secondary sanctions, it's an extra layer of sanctions that they apply on certain targets only. So it's not for every target in the OFAC list, but for certain targets or certain sanctions program, they essentially apply an extraterritorial layer to their measures. And what they say, like, how does that work? Because it's always kind of tricky to understand how that works. In the actual US law, you will have a mention saying that foreign persons are required not to deal with people designated under this regulation, right? And so that translates into the record of the targets in the list have a mention about secondary sanctions risk. Yes, there is a secondary sanctions risk. So essentially, what it means by secondary sanctions is that if you work with the US targets, you may run the risk of yourself becoming a target in the list. So just by the threats of becoming yourself sanctioned because of your dealings with the primary target, the incentive in general is to everybody stops dealing with those persons. Just the threat of becoming sanctioned.
I've got probably one last question for you, Vincent, which is, what are the risks? Okay, what are the penalties? Okay, so let's take South Africa, because that's what we're talking about kind of today. A company in South Africa doesn't comply, or has a maybe has some compliance, but it's circumnavigated or it's not robust enough. And they're seen, there's an investigation and it comes out that there's been, you know, money laundering that has come through that business. Okay. Deliberately or not, that's irrelevant. What are the penalties? Is it too late then to sort of retrospectively go and sort of, you know, plead, apologies and go and, then put in sort of systems and processes in place to ensure this happens again? How serious is this from a business perspective?
So I don't know the local rules. I don't know exactly how much you risk. What I can tell you, I can give you a generic answer. Kind of,
please, yeah.
It's really part of the solution to have at least the prospect that you will get heavy fines if you are caught if you don't comply. You know, back to your earlier question on the lawyer. That okay, they take a good fee. They do the operation. You can't assume professionals to do the right thing or to care for preventing money laundering, etc. Personal opinion, but you need to have a fear or at least an expectation that if you screw up, you will get caught. And if you get caught, you will pay a hefty price. So basically, it's about, you know, providing the incentive, like the cost of non-compliance exceeds the cost of compliance, right? So the answer would be that, and actually it's part of the standards, that deficiencies should be subject to dissuasive fines, right? So you need to have an expectation by the private sector that supervision is effectively happening, and that if yeah. the supervisors sees some deficiencies, there is a price to pay. So the price will be the direct fine, the cost of remediation, something that we often overlook, but that can be massive, you know, to get all things in order. If you have really overlooked those topics for a year and have grown into a big business, just to get things in order, that can be a massive cost. The loss of trust from your counterparties and like all of the relationships that you need to rebuild, etc., and reputation towards the public. So there's really, and there should be, in my opinion, there should be a hefty price to pay if you really break those rules and don't keep up with those requirements.
Because there may be people listening to this podcast thinking, you know, they've got a small fintech, or they may have a real estate agency, or they may be lawyers with a small law firm, and going, hang on, I haven't got hundreds of thousands of dollars or rands or whatever currency we're talking about to go and invest in these really complex, you know, AML solutions. Where do they go? Are there sort of other service provided? Maybe LexisNexis Risk Solutions has something, you know, for the SME market. I genuinely don't know. But are there sort of solutions available to SME businesses that will help them navigate these types of complexities and to ensure that they are as compliant as they possibly can be without having to have, you know, a three-man or three-person law firm having a chief compliance officer, right? How does that work in that part of the market?
I mean, obviously, it doesn't have to be. I mean, you can't expect a small fintech to have the same program as a huge bank, that's for sure. But what you need to have is a commensurate response to your exposure to risk, right? It needs to be commensurate. What I mean by that is that it's, in my opinion, a very bad strategy to just bury your hand in the sand and hope that those issues never touch you. It's better to integrate that into, like, at the early stage, right? That's part of the initial equation. And the longer you wait, the more painful it will be to sort things out. So back to your initial question. Of course, there are some simple solutions that you can use to check that you are not dealing with someone that is on the US list for involvement into human rights violation or a known terrorist or a proliferator in dangerous weapons or you name it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, those subjects, those risks, this is serious. You know, it's really about making our economies healthier, more secure. So I think it's not theoretical, and it doesn't have to be very complicated, but you need to realize that depending on your profession, you have an exposure, and therefore just face it and implement the right responses to get some assurance.
Well, thank you. I think that's useful advice to anyone that's listening here that maybe isn't working in a large corporate and doesn't have sort of, you know, big compliance teams and what have you. So thank you. One thing just, I'm going to mention just before we go. Yeah, sorry, go on, Vincent. Yeah, if you've got something to add, go for it. Yeah.
No, just to echo what you're saying, just a simple web lookup tool, right? You get something entering your office, gives you an ID, just to put that into one of our web lookup tools. Just to be safe, okay, maybe probably it will be nothing, but the day that you find that this person is subject to an asset freeze, well, that may avoid a lot of trouble in the future. So yeah, definitely better be safe than sorry, as the saying goes, right?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. On this subject of financial crime, Vincent, I wasn't sure if you're aware, because you're obviously based in Paris, but we're running a conference or an exhibition, actually, later on this year with LexisNexis Risk Solutions as one of the key partners, called Decoding Financial Crime, with a focus here in South Africa. And we have convicted money launderers who are now reformed. We have a former detective who spent his entire career combating and finding, you know, financial criminals. We have Chatham House Rules. We have all of these very, very sort of different aspects of financial crime to really, I think, give our audience, who are going to be made up of, you know, the financial services providers and the regulators, an insight into actually how financial criminals think. As you said quite rightly at the very early on, this is not now just, you know, one individual sitting there with a dark cloak on, you know, trying to defraud. This is big business, right? This can be state sponsored. There could be hundreds, if not thousands, of people working in these, you know, sweatshops trying to defraud people. You know, what does that look like? How do you combat that? There's obviously other aspects of the financial crime that we haven't delved into today, but hopefully we'll get a chance to do so in the future. I'm going to put some links to a couple of the resources you mentioned at the bottom of this. And I think my message to anyone that's listening to this, whether you're working in a corporate or you're working in you know, a startup or an SME business, is, as Vincent said, just doing a quick lookup at a very basic level. It's better to be safe than sorry. You know, we're not talking here about a slap on the wrist. We're talking here about serious, serious implications for you as an individual and your business and anyone connected with that. So, you know, please take this very, very seriously. It is something that we need to, as an industry, as a global community, work together to try and combat, because as Vincent was saying, you know, this is not just about a bit of money that's, you know, being laundered. This is about human trafficking, wildlife, which we haven't had a chance to speak about, but hopefully we will do in the future. This is about arms dealing. This is really, really important stuff. So please, you know, follow Vincent on LinkedIn. I think that's the best place to find him. I'll put a link as well down there. And if you've got any questions off the back of this podcast, feel free to drop them in the comments or drop them in the question session. And I'll loop back with Vincent and his team, and we'll try and get through as many as we possibly can. But Vincent, I just wanted to say a big thank you. You know, this is Thursday, the 28th of March, just before the long weekend. So thank you for taking the time. If you've got any sort of last comments, feel free to do so. If not, I'll go and let you enjoy your, I was going to say your baguette, but that's
a bit cliche, isn't it?
It is a bit, isn't it? Yeah.
I do love baguette though, but okay.
Me too. I
have one last note, because so obviously everybody is talking about like the grey listing of in South Africa, and like, I would like to look at it positively, because I think it's the great occasion for this to be a wake up call in the country about these issues, right? So let's look at it collectively. Let's face it. There are some issues. We are not doing everything correctly, and it takes a collective effort. It takes a cultural change, and so it's really like it's timely that okay, we do better against financial crime.
Absolutely.
I'll conclude on that note, you know, of hope, right? Let's.
Yeah, listen, we could talk about the grey listing another time, but I think, you know, what we have seen is, you know, industry, governments, everyone coming together to not only to ensure that South Africa comes off of the grey list, but to ensure it doesn't happen again. And I think that's the most important thing is, you know, take the lessons that are learned, make sure we make some changes, make sure that doesn't happen again. And then we hopefully South Africa has a brighter future on the international stage.
Yeah, it takes a team to fight these very organized actors. And yeah, we stand ready to support the private sector or regulators if they need us. We want to be part of the solution because, again, very important solutions need to be found.
Absolutely. Vincent, thank you very much. I say au revoir.
Thank you.
And I can't say have a nice Easter in French. That's au revoir is about as best as you're going to get from me. I'm a French.
So it's a joyeuse Pâques in French. And yeah, I wish you a very happy Easter. Thanks for having me, Darren. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Vincent.
Thank you. Speak soon.